We're getting a glimpse inside the world of major league eating here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. I think of Joey Chestnut for reference. He won his 14th title and coveted muster belt at Nathan's famous 4th of July hot dog eating contest, gulping down 76 hot dogs in 10 minutes, breaking his own record by one dog set last year. So how many hot dogs can you swallow in 10 minutes? Are you into competitive eating or been part of an eating contest? 800-642-1234. Competitive eater Catherine Tesh lives in the village of Dorchester, Wisconsin. She finished 10th in the women's division at the contest in Coney Island and is ranked 44th in major league eating. Catherine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello.
Hello. Well, help us. Give us the backstory. How did you become a competitive eater?
Well, I guess I didn't really do, I don't really do other foods. I just, my mom and I have watched the contest every year for, since it's been on TV. And when they created a women's division, it kind of seemed like something, hey, I can do that. And then it was kind of a bet. And then it just happened.
When did they create a women's division?
I think they've had a women's division for 9 years now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you, as you were watching the contest through the years with your mom, what was going through your head at, with all of these contestants on stage and just, you know, gulping those dogs as fast as they can?
I don't know. I just thought I want to try it. So I have a kind of a say yes mentality. So I just went for it.
So besides hot dogs, which foods do you are on your competitive roster? Which ones do you do?
Actually, that's it for now. I haven't been able to go to any other contests because I'm in the Air Force Reserve now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my weekends fall on a lot of the contests, so I can't actually go to most of them.
Yeah. So when you start preparing for a contest, can you walk us through how you, you know, how you work up to it?
Mostly about capacity training and I guess getting your stomach ready to expand. But a lot of it is, you know, low-calorie, high-volume foods, you know, a lot of salads, a lot of water.
So,
the thinner you are, the thinner you are, the more capacity you have for potential. So it's wise not to just be eating a lot of hot dogs.
Yeah.
All the time, yeah.
You know, do you think there is a stigma with women and competitive eating, or is it widely accepted?
I don't think either of those things. I think people don't realize that women can do it too, because they're not as publicized as the men, because obviously Joey has incredibly ridiculous numbers, so people want to see that. But the women, even though, like, our top lady can do 47 to 50, which is absolutely incredible, we don't really get the same kind of press coverage.
Yeah, Joey Chestnut really overshadows everyone else out there, especially in the women's division, is what I'm hearing you saying.
Pretty much. I mean, he overshadows everybody in the men's division, too. So it's not, you know, like, for real, they'll interview the men, other men, and all they do is talk about how are we going to beat Joey, Joey this, mm-hmm. Joey that, Joey this. It's pretty, I mean, it's hard to contest how good he is, mm-hmm. but at the same time, there are other people.
Yeah, I mean, you've been to the contest, Nathan's hot dog eating contest, 3 times now. Have you met Joey?
Yeah.
What is he like?
I suppose a regular guy, but he has a lot of media responsibilities and, you know, things that come with being the face of an entire organization. So, you know, he tries to stay as grounded and speak to as many people on a, you know, face-to-face level. But, you know, he has a lot of, there's a lot of stress when you're the guy.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Catherine Tesh, who is a Wisconsin-based competitive eater. He competed for a third time at the Nathan's International Hot Dog Eating Contest this month. You can join in. Did you watch it, or do you have a tradition of watching the contest? Are you a competitive eater? Where do you compete? What's your favorite food to eat in competitive mode? How do you train? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Catherine, you know, I'm wondering, as you go back to the contest, you know, each year, do you find that you get better, or do you find ways to improve?
This year, not so much. The first year was kind of, I'm going to see if I can do it. And then I did it, and I was like, oh, this is really fun. So the next year in 19, I practiced a little more, and I got quite a bit better. And then 2020 happened, and, you know, everything got shut down.
Yeah.
And then this year they invited ranked eaters because we didn't have any qualifiers. And I got a call like 2 weeks notice. And at that point, there wasn't really much I could do in terms of getting ready. So it kind of was just, I'll say yes and see what happens and then train again for next year.
Okay, yeah. So how do you maintain or improve your ranking in major league eating?
Doing better. Doing better. Some of my other female friends, they go to a lot of other contests. That's how they've increased theirs.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's just, you know, I've placed fairly well at Nathan's. And since Nathan's is the Super Bowl of eating, my ranking has done pretty well because of that.
What is the atmosphere like when you get to Coney Island and you're there? What does it feel like?
It's very exciting. Like, it's exciting, and there's just such a crowd that are so invested. Like, it's these people come, you know, every year. It's just their big holiday, and you get to be a part of it.
Sounds like you can really, you know, feel the energy.
Oh, for sure. Yes.
What is the atmosphere like on stage, and especially during the 10 minutes of eating?
This year was a little bit different for me because it was kind of like a, well, I'm not prepared for this, but it's happening anyway kind of feeling. But I guess even in the other years, it's the fastest 10 minutes of your life. It's crazy how you can watch it, and it seems like from you know, on TV you're watching it, and it seems like it's a long 10 minutes. It's like, wow, they're going so fast, and but it seems like it takes a long time to get to the 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. But when you're up on stage, it's like just a flash. It's just gone, just like that.
What is going through your mind as you pound those hot dogs on stage?
Just get through it. It's very difficult. Like, I've run, you know, half marathons. I've done duathlons. I've done, you know, every sport, basically. I went through basic training. That first qualifier I did in Florida in 2018, that was the hardest 10 minutes of my life. That was the absolute hardest thing I had ever tried to accomplish. So when I say it's not for everyone, it really is not.
How does your stomach feel after the competition?
To be honest, I don't have too many problems because I don't consume them. I mean, 10 in 10 minutes is nothing compared to most people. And it's better than, you know, a regular person trying to eat them. But I have a lot of capacity, but not a lot of speed. So once I figure that out, then I guess I could let you know how my stomach feels.
We have Wisconsin-based competitive eater Catherine Tesh with us, ranked 44th in the world by Major League Eating, finished 10th in the women's division, as we've been talking about, at the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest earlier this month. What questions do you have about training for eating competitions? Are you a competitive eater? What's your favorite food to eat? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Catherine Tesh here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring what it's like to be a competitive eater here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Pancakes, pies, chicken wings, tamales, of course, hot dogs. The governing body is called Major League Eating, which promotes competitive eating at the highest levels. Have you judged or watched an eating contest? How do you feel about the contest food afterward? Apparently, it's called a reversal if a contest or a contestant regurgitates on that thought. Sorry, how about the number 800-642-1234? Catherine Tesh is a competitive eater based in the village of Dorchester, which is near Wausau, and she's with us for about 10 more minutes. Catherine, you mentioned water a bit earlier. Can you talk about your strategy and your use with water in keeping the hot dogs down?
Well, for me, I flavor the water, so I use lemonade because it makes the hot dog bun itself not taste quite as nasty. But a lot of the other competitors use a fruit punch based taste, or some people use they have a little bit of like Diet Coke or whatever with the bubbles because it helps clear a burp so that you have more space. Or, you know, a lot of them like to use hot water.
Really?
I don't really like, I don't know. I tried hot water. It doesn't really do much difference for me.
But, what would be the strategy around hot water? Why would you use it?
It helps to melt the bun a lot faster.
Mm. Yeah.
When you're dunking it, yeah.
Are there any rules about how much water or liquid you can drink?
There isn't. You just have to specify how many cups of water you want, or liquid, I guess. And you can bring your own liquids. You just have to put them in the Nathan's cups. And then what you have is what you have. You don't get more. So you have to know a ballpark of what you're going to consume.
Yeah.
But so the least amount of water is going to be beneficial because you're filling your stomach.
Yeah. And I mean, you talk about keeping this food down. How difficult is it to keep it down?
I don't have any problems because, again, I'm not consuming, you know, 20, 25 hot dogs and buns. So for me, it hasn't been an issue. For others, there's a, you know, dark underbelly of that. That, I mean, I don't see it, so I don't know what happens. But, you know, you can imagine how difficult that could be to keep 30 hot dogs in your body.
Yeah. When you go over how a competition went, how the contest went, do you walk through in your head? Do you rewatch yourself? How do you work to improve?
I don't rewatch myself. It kind of weirds me out. I just, you know, visualize what happened, what motions I went through, and then, again, like this year was kind of just a wash for me because I didn't have any real time to prepare. So I know what does work. So I'm going to, you know, continue on that trajectory next year for the contest.
So what does work to build capacity?
A lot of cardio, a lot of large salads, and a lot of like intense gum chewing that helps your jaws a lot.
Wait, tell us about the gum. What's going on there?
Well, most people say that helps, you know, strengthen your jaws if you use a lot of gum, you know, to chew.
Mm-hmm.
Or like how Joey uses the Jawsercise little ball that you actually, I don't know, you bite onto it. And neither of those things really work too well for me because I have arthritis in my jaws, so I can't really focus a lot of my time and effort on jaw strength. I have to focus my time on speed and capacity and getting through it, because otherwise it's a lot of pain.
Yeah, what is it like to have arthritis in your jaws?
Well, it's on a normal day-to-day basis, it's fine. You wouldn't even notice. I just don't chew gum. I don't chew things for long periods of time. I mean, I was a little kid when they said, you know, I had a problem with my jaws, and And they were like, no more gum chewing. And I was like a professional head-sized bubblegum blowing champion, you know, in my mind.
And, right, right.
I just stopped chewing gum. That was how that went.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with competitive eater Catherine Tesh. She's been competing in the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest since 2018, this year finishing 10th in the women's division. You can join in. What questions do you have for training or about these eating competitions? What do you want to know as a spectator or a judge? Join in 800-642-1234. Catherine, explain the role of the judges. How do they work?
Each individual eater has a counter who are supposed to be impartial, and they count, you know, how many hot dogs you're eating as you're eating them. And then there's an overall, all over the top of them is another judge who comes at the end to verify your number and then verify how much debris you have and if they're going to take deductions or anything like that. So they're pretty important in terms of that, because sometimes, some years, the deductions are less, and some years the, you know, deductions are more. This year it seemed like there were a few more deductions than usual.
Is it
debris?
Yeah, is it difficult for judges to, you know, keep count? It's going really fast.
I would imagine it's a difficult task,
yeah,
because it's a lot of things happening in a very short span of time.
Well, let's take a call now. Nadine is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Nadine.
Good morning. I couldn't help but think about how people struggle to put food on their table. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that the organization does to help feed those who are in need.
Nadine, thank you for that. Catherine, do you know?
Yes, actually, Nathan's donates literally millions of hot dogs every year. And through the contest, they fill a lot of food banks in New York. And then one of the girls on the women's side actually runs it's not food, but she runs a clean water organization. So she raises money to get people clean water all over the world.
What is the effects of the food waste that happens with these competitions? Do you know the extent of it?
I don't really know the extent of it. They do everything that they cook that's extra all gets donated.
What do you think it would take to be a Michelle Lesko of Tucson who took home the women's title by eating 30 and three quarter hot dogs in 10 minutes? What is that like?
I think it takes a lot of practice. She's been doing this for a lot of years, and also, it's a weird skill to have, but not everybody can just eat a whole bunch of food in a really short amount of time, you know? It's not a talent you just unlock randomly, mm-hmm. I guess. So I think a regular person like a Katie Prettyman, who's on the women's side, who finished fourth this year, she was just a mega fan, basically, and was like, I'm going to try and do this. And even with no real, I guess, skill or talent, she, you know, there's eating coaches. She hired an eating coach, and now she's fourth in the world for the women. So anybody could do it if you put in the time and effort.
Yeah, how do you know if you have the skill and you have the talent? What are those signs?
You just got to want to do it and go try it.
What is your next goal? What are you working on?
I guess for next year, my goal is to qualify with a much higher number and then actually prove that I'm decent enough to be there at the final table.
And you've had a struggle to try to make time for doing all of the training and what you need to do to prepare. Do you think that that aspect will get easier at all?
I think everyone has enough time for anything they want to accomplish. You just have to make the time. That's it. So I can make all the excuses I want, but that's all it is. So if you want it, you can make the time. There's always time. that's really how I, you have to focus if you really want it. That's it.
Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Catherine Tesh is a competitive eater from Wisconsin, also a dairy farmer, by the way, ranked number 44 in the world by Major League Eating. Coming up, leaving the policing profession in droves, departments straight across the country are facing a wave of retirements and resignations and struggling to recruit new officers. We check in with the head of Wisconsin's largest police organization about the departures and police morale. Are you an officer? Is your department struggling with turnover? 800-642-1234. We'll talk about the shortage after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about police officer turnover and the future of the law enforcement profession. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Police morale has plummeted. Retirements and resignations have soared. A survey last month of nearly 200 police departments revealed a 45% increase in the retirement rate and an 18% increase in resignations year over year. So that's from the nonprofit Police Executive Research Forum. Are you an officer? How has the stress of the job and calls for reform affected you and your department? Join in 800-642-1234. Jim Palmer is executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, the state's largest police union representing more than 10,000 law enforcement officers. Jim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Good morning. We see that massive turnover nationally. What's the view like inside Wisconsin? Is there a similar level of flux?
Well, there are no cumulative numbers, or there's no data that tracks staffing on that kind of basis. But from every indicator that we can see, the numbers of police officers here in Wisconsin and what's happening to them is consistent with what we're seeing across the country. And that is a pretty consistent decline in the number of applicants and an increase in the number of officers that are retiring and leaving the profession entirely.
So what do you hear then? What do officers tell you about why they're leaving?
Well, a number of things. I think there's, it's a stressful job. Certainly it's a dangerous job. And the fact of the matter is that people today there are a lot of occupations that they can go into that pay better and don't require them to, risk their safety and the livelihood of their families. Also, the public scrutiny, I think, plays a significant role in the decisions that officers are facing. And so there's just stress, danger, and a lot of public scrutiny. I think all of these things are kind of coming to a head. And the last year only served to exacerbate that dynamic, which has been growing for a number of years.
Yeah, I want to pick up there on that public scrutiny, because there's this broader narrative out there that police are leaving the force due to the protests, due to high-profile police killings, and that their power is being called into question. Is this narrative accurate for the rise, for the increased turnover? Can you make these connections and inferences?
Well, I think there is certainly the public perception, a perception amongst officers that they have less support amongst the general public than they once did. Our organization has been conducting a statewide poll through the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute for the last 9 years, and we've consistently found that that's simply not the case, that in fact, officers do enjoy a great deal of support amongst the general public, and that the public vastly believes that keeping the community safe from crime is the top priority for our state and local governments. And so these are messages that we try and get out there, and at the same time, confront and discuss and engage in a meaningful dialogue some of the issues and concerns that people have about policing in the state of Wisconsin.
You've been doing your poll for nearly a decade now. I mean, taking that pulse on what the public feels about policing. And I was surprised by this year's results and that respondents are overwhelmingly approving of how their local police force is doing their job, almost 4 in 5. Do you think this is aligning with the national sentiment and the protests of use of force and racial bias?
Well, I think what we see not only from our poll, but from other national polls is that you know, the narratives that we see reflected, particularly in the national news media, aren't reflective of where people really are in terms of how they feel about police. Certainly people have concerns. And one thing that we have seen is that a majority of individuals, both Republicans and Democrats, I believe that some amount of policing, some amount of change, rather, needs to occur in policing. And so that's something we want to be receptive to. And also, I think it's worth noting and important to note that while officers in Wisconsin, the law enforcement community enjoys a great deal of public support, there are disparities between different demographic groups. And we think that's it's an important thing for us to acknowledge and work to remedy that as best we can.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, as we look at sentiment about the policing profession and what it means for retaining and recruiting officers. You can join in. What's been the hardest part about being a police officer? Have you recently retired from the force? How did the job change over the years? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jim, what has morale been like since the murder of George Floyd among officers?
Well, from every indicator, again, that we've seen, it's been pretty devastating. Again, regardless of where I go throughout the state, when I interact with our members, our officers, our chiefs or sheriffs, they consistently, with very few exceptions, identify the challenge of you know, having fewer fewer qualified applicants applying for positions. And that is something that is really concerning when you consider that you know, the number of retirements does appear to be up. And just in Milwaukee, for instance, on the last this year, I think the number of retirements is up 30% over the year before. And that doesn't even account for the fact that the Milwaukee city budget additionally eliminated 120 officer positions. So that is very concerning. We think that's counterproductive to the kind of policing that Wisconsinites want, particularly communities of color, because the fewer officers we have, you know, I think we're going to see less, you know, proactive programs such as community policing. And our polling has consistently showed that communities of color in particular, they want more officers, not less. And they want officers, you know, working in their neighborhoods and getting to know them and engaging in the kind of community policing and relationship building that's crucial to bridging the gap and strengthening the relationship between officers and the communities they serve.
The perception of law enforcement being a very dangerous profession, you know, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, police officers, it's not among the nation's 10 most dangerous jobs. Do officers, do you think, have an inflated sense of how dangerous the job is?
Well, I think officers recognize that they have a dangerous job, and you know, we're fortunate that they also have a high level of training, and so that does allow them to protect themselves to a significant extent. But I do think it's you know, law enforcement is a unique calling, and we really honestly believe it is a calling that, you know, for someone to go into a profession that requires them to, you know, put the safety of their neighbors and of others in their community ahead of their own, is pretty extraordinary, and that's something we ought to celebrate and work to protect and promote. And I think Wisconsin has made great strides, and the law enforcement community has made great strides in elevating the training and certification standards. Our polling consistently shows a lot of support for that. And I think the last thing we want to do is restrict or diminish those standards in order to bring more people into the profession. Because I think that would be detrimental to some of the things that we're trying to confront in terms of the relationship between law enforcement and the communities they serve.
So, Jim, what needs to happen then to recruit more police officers?
Well, there are some agencies throughout the state that I think have kind of stand out in terms of the strategies that they've employed. The city of Wausau, for example, for several years has been very proactive in you know, highlighting the diversity and the mission and the mission of public service in the law enforcement profession. I think that has served them very well. I also think, you know, law enforcement generally needs to more proactively engage in the public discourse and confront a lot of these issues. You know, our organization, we discussed our poll earlier, you know, we're the only law enforcement group in the country that undertakes such an effort. And we think it has served us and our members throughout the state very well. It's allowed us to, you know, establish relationships with communities of color and to really play an influential and more assertive role in the public dialogue on these issues. And we think that's something that agencies have been doing with increasing frequency over the last decade, but that's something that needs to continue to grow.
You know, you mentioned WASA, and it reminds me of WASA's police chief, Ben Bliven, who we've talked with on our show, and we've talked with about the killing of George Floyd. And something that sticks with me in talking with him is that he said he loves the policing profession, but when he saw that killing, it went against everything he stands for in his profession. And he says that you need to have the training that supports equity and equality. So I'm wondering, is it the tone, the morals, the values that you set at the top of your police department that impacts, you know, how many people you can recruit and who stays?
Oh, I think there's certainly something to that. And you know, we've spent a good portion of the last year trying to distinguish the training and professionalism standards, high standards that we have here in Wisconsin against those that we've seen in some of these horrific instances, such as the murder of George Floyd. Because, you know, Wisconsin, by and large, is you know, well ahead of the curve compared to its peers throughout the country in terms of training, in terms of the type of training that we have and the rules by which our officers' actions are governed and considered. There's a lot of transparency and accountability here, and we think those are important distinctions to draw. But it's certainly that, you know, the morale and the mission of an agency, it stems from its leadership. And you know, Wisconsin is blessed with wonderful sheriffs and chiefs by and large who do great work in leading their agencies and trying to fulfill their public mission.
Let's bring in Laura in Madison. Laura, what are your thoughts?
Hi. I have always been a big supporter of the police and how hard their job is. But through this, you know, past year, my, you know, feelings have started to change. And I know someone whose, you know, brother was a police officer. And he said that he got out of it. He found that about a third of the cops are good officers. They really want to, you know, help the community. About a third, he said, are people who just, you know, say, this is a good paying job with good benefits. I show up, I leave the job at the job and go home. And he said fully another third are angry people who are just looking for the opportunity, any reason at all, to beat the crap out of people. Excuse my language. Beat the heck out of people. So I'm wondering if your guest has any ideas on how to weed out on the front end. I mean, if they already don't have enough people applying, how do they be rigorous in weeding out the people who have the temperament problems?
Who are not treating it as a calling. Yeah. Jim Palmer.
Well, I appreciate that perspective. You know, I think it's not in line with my experience in dealing with officers. I mean, frankly, and I've represented quite a few officers. Our organization represents year in and year out most the officers involved in things, critical incidents such as officer-involved shooting. And I have yet to meet an officer that reported to duty on any particular day, you know, looking to harm someone. Frankly, officers just want to go home and be able to return to their families. You know, as far as how we elevate and strengthen the law enforcement profession, our organization has long supported advancements in that area. In fact, we've supported legislation that's working through the state legislature now that would, you know, mandate transparency in the hiring process. And that's something that we fully support because, you know, we recognize, and I think officers recognize, that no one wants a bad cop out of the profession more than a good one. And, you know, it's those bad officers that are few and far between that really mar the profession in a way that's, you know, destructive. And it's something that we need to combat and do what we can to elevate the quality of the candidates and the people that are entering this profession and doing this terribly difficult job.
Laura, thanks for calling in. We're talking with the head of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, Jim Palmer, as we look at resignations, retirements that connect to the national conversation on what police do, how they're funded, how to better hold officers accountable for excessive force. Have you recently retired from the force? How did the job change? What's the hardest part of being an officer? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jim Palmer on the Ideas Network. We're talking about policing on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers last month signed 4 policing bills that grew out of the work of the Assembly's Task Force on Racial Disparities. We had reaction from Democratic Representative Sheila Stubbs, who co-chaired the task force in the wake of the shooting of Jacob Blake by a Kenosha police officer last August.
I want to be clear with you, Kate, and the rest of your listeners, that these are bills are not the only bills that we think are going to, you know, properly addressed, but it's a start. It's a step. It's a foundation. It's the floor of the entire criminal justice system. But I do think there's still so much work that needs to be done.
How do you feel about the status of legislation on accountability and use of force? 800-642-1234. We have Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Let's bring in another call now. Greg is joining us from Stoughton. Greg, hi.
Hello. I have a couple issues that I want to bring up. One, I'm shocked that there is support of the police union for the proliferation of guns. They always have, even assault rifles. Second, the support of Donald Trump at a time when the insurrection showed so many policemen there. The support of the union for Donald Trump, it offends me. Third, under under George Bush Jr., there was a RAND study that told us we had more to fear from white-wing extremists than we did from inborn Islam or Muslims.
Greg, let's pause there and get Jim to respond on the role of and influence of police unions.
Well, I think that you know, police unions nationally have not served a constructive role in the public discourse in the way that they can. You know, I mentioned our polling and the fact that, you know, we try to use that as a foundation, you know, for the last 9 years to go around the state and play an assertive role in this discussion. But again, we're the only police group in the country that has done so. Last September, we put out the most, you know, cumulative series of reform proposals of any police group in the country. In fact, we're the only one that has. And I think that's, you know, I don't say that to pat ourselves on the back necessarily, but I think the fact that, you know, police unions, law enforcement unions across the country haven't been more proactively engaged in the public discourse on these issues in a meaningful way is problematic.
Well, I want to get your take on this. When a use of force policy was sent to Governor Evers' desk, it had been amended in the Assembly with the power and influence of the Milwaukee Police Union, driving that amendment through to remove criminal liability for an officer who reasonably should have intervened when another officer is illegally using force. How do you feel about the union's actions there and this amendment?
Well, I think the change that was made, frankly, was the bill, as it was originally drafted, raised the questions of some in the law enforcement community as to, you know, whether or not we were inviting unreasonable scrutiny and creating some new standard. And so I think the end result, as amended, more closely reflects the recommendation of the Task Force on Racial Disparities, in which I had the distinct honor of serving on. It was a very worthwhile undertaking, and I'm proud to have played a small role in that. So I think, you know, there are some that have been critical for that organization, you know, kind of coming in late and voicing its concerns. But, you know, there were a lot of police groups, law enforcement groups throughout the state that were engaged in this discussion. And I don't think that that change fundamentally undermined the bill. And it certainly didn't fundamentally undermine the task force recommendation.
Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Let's go to Mary now in Waukesha. Mary, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question has to do with the use of force. I recall a time when a police officer would disarm the individual, maybe use a taser gun, or a person would be shot in the leg. And it seems we have turned into a different priority now where the person is automatically shot dead as opposed to just disarming or disabling the person. I'm wondering why and when that change occurred.
Mary, questioning the escalation and where use of force policies are, Jim.
That's a fair question. I think it kind of highlights, you know, some of the misconceptions that people have, whether it's from things they see in television. But it's never been the case that officers were trained to, you know, shoot an armed individual in the arm or in the leg. I mean, officers are trained to stop the threat, not only to protect themselves, but certainly to protect the public. With regard to tasers, taser policies throughout the state generally are authorized when an officer has what they call lethal coverage. That is another officer that has his gun drawn. Going back to, kind of the beginning of this discussion, you know, when we have a shortage of officers and some real genuine police staffing challenges, it increases the likelihood that an officer is going to be confronting a situation alone without the same availability of backup, and that they're going to have to resort to lethal force because they don't have that, that reinforcement.
So you were on the speaker's task force, developed 18 recommendations. When you look at use of force policies and what is needed, what kind of increased oversight do you support?
Well, in Wisconsin, you know, we have we already do have a lot of oversight. I think that's an important thing to talk about and acknowledge. I mean, we have, you know, police and fire commissions here in Wisconsin, which is civilian oversight. And we've had it for over 100 years. And so I think that's notable. But in terms of other forms of oversight, I think we have an independent investigations law, as you well know. And Wisconsin was the first state in the nation to enact a law that mandates an outside investigation by another agency of any officer involved death. And that was in 2014. I mentioned earlier, there's legislation that we strongly support that would mandate more transparency in the hiring process. So, you know, to eliminate the chances for an officer that, perhaps shouldn't be in the profession from simply, you know, dodging trouble in one agency and moving to another one that might not might be unsuspecting of their prior personnel history. We want to avoid that. We want the best officers that we can, and we want to diminish the opportunities for officers that shouldn't be in the profession to do the job.
Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jim Palmer is executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, the state's largest union representing more than 10,000 law enforcement officers. Stay with us. We take a look at the neobank industry and payment apps like Venmo, Zelle, and Chime on how to keep your money safe and what hidden fees to watch for. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.